Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this FedSoc forum called Litigation Transparency Act of 2025, Patents, Policy, and Legal Ethics. Speaking with us today, we're very pleased to have Dean Kristen Osenga of the University of Richmond School of Law, Courtney Quish of Fortress Investment, Jonathan Stroud of Unified Patents, and Paul Taylor of GMU's Antonin Scalia Law School. And moderating the discussion, we have Casey Donovan. Casey's an associate at Greenberg Traurig, where she focuses her practice on complex commercial litigation, particularly intellectual property claims. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we may turn to the audience for questions. So if you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers and not the Federalist Society. And with that, Casey, thanks so much for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Thanks so much, Edie, and thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this program. Thank you all for joining us. It's a great pleasure to be here. We have a lot to cover today, so I'll jump right in. I'm honored to introduce our distinguished panel. We have Courtney Quish. She's a managing director for the Fortress Credit Funds business, where she heads asset management for Fortress's intellectual property finance group. In this role, she provides counsel and advice to portfolio companies that are engaged in monetization efforts. Ms. Quish has 20 years of experience assessing and monetizing patent assets. She's been recognized by Intellectual Asset Magazine on a number of occasions. She's been identified as one of the world global leaders in IP and the world's leading IP strategist. Thank you so much, Courtney. We're so happy to have you with us. She earned her JD from the University of Michigan Law School and her BA with high honors from Middlebury College. Our next panelist is Jonathan Stroud. Jonathan is general counsel of Unified Patents. He regularly speaks, writes, and lectures about patents, administrative law, and litigation financing. Previously, Mr. Stroud was a patent attorney at Finnegan, Henderson, Farabaugh, Garrett, and Dunner, LLP, where he was involved in some of the earliest post-grant review work. Before that, he examined patents on implantable medical devices at the USPTO. Jonathan has been published in the Columbia Science and Technology Law Review, the Administrative Law Review, the South Carolina Law Review, among others. Our next distinguished panelist is Paul Taylor. Mr. Taylor was counsel and chief counsel of the House Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties for over 20 years, where he shepherded dozens of bills through committee to be signed into law by presidents of both political parties. He was also counsel to the House Oversight Committee, where he handled constitutional and civil rights issues. He's the author of over a dozen law review articles on legal reform, continuity in government, religious liberty, civil rights, patent law, among other things. He's an elected member of the American Law Institute and a 1991 graduate of Yale University and a 1994 graduate of Harvard Law School. He is a visiting fellow at the National Security Institute at George Mason University's Antonin Scalia Law School. And last, but certainly not least, is Dean Kristen Osenga. She teaches and writes in the areas of intellectual property, patent law, and legislation and regulation. Dean Osenga is an active member of the Federal Circuit Bar Association and the American Intellectual Property Law Association. Dean Osenga received a BS in biomedical engineering from the University of Iowa, an MS in electrical engineering from Southern Illinois University, Carbondale, and a JD from the University of Illinois College of Law, where she graduated magna cum laude. Thank you all so much for being with us. I'd love to jump right in and talk about the Litigation Transparency Act of 2025. But to kick us off and ground our audience a bit, I'd love to kick it over to Courtney, who's going to give us an overview of litigation funding. And Courtney, just kind of, for example, how does it typically work in practice? What types of cases tend to attract litigation funding? Maybe just a basic definition, just a little bit of grounding for our audience, if you would.
Yeah, absolutely. So I will say, after, you know, I went back and looked at what we are talking about here, and obviously what we are when we're focused on the Litigation Transparency Act, it's not really just about litigation funding. But so I'd love to give a couple minutes of just table setting and then go into your few questions, Casey. So the first is just preliminary points here. For our group at Fortress, the Intellectual Property Finance Group, we only invest about 5% of our fund in what we would call, and what I will describe and sort of at a high level to everyone on this call, litigation funding. So enough that I certainly can speak to the overview of litigation funding, but it's not an overall large part of our fund. The majority of our fund is a bit different from traditional litigation funding, and it comes in two forms. One, debt investments, providing loans to operating businesses, and two, traditional private equity investments, where we make equity investments in standalone companies. In both of these, Fortress is the investment manager, just to be clear, right? And we are placing capital on behalf of our investors. The reason why I call this out is because the Litigation Transparency Act really is so much broader than the litigation funding itself. And so I want to be clear that this is important to me, even though only 5% of our fund, again, is traditional litigation funding. So, and we'll go, I guess we'll go back to this later, but to start off and ground, the proposed language of this bill requires disclosure of the identity of any person, right, that has a gift to receive any payment or thing of value that is contingent on the outcome of the civil action. And so, while we will focus on litigation funding, I just want to highlight to this audience that the proposed language is so much broader than that, right? And it seeks identification of every individual. That means any employee who has equity, any outside investor that has equity, all members of outside investors. So we will focus on litigation funding, but please, for everyone in the audience, understand that this language is so, so much broader than that. So what is litigation funding? Litigation funding, also called litigation financing, is a process through which individuals, corporate entities, public or private, and even law firms may access capital to finance fees and costs associated with litigation through a third-party funder. Litigation funding gained traction. I mean, it's really been around for a long, long time, but it gained a lot of traction as litigation became more and more expensive over the last 10 to 20 years. The reality today is that many could not afford to access the courts without litigation funding. The most standard form of litigation funding is when a third party provides non-recourse financing to a litigant to cover some or all of the fees and expenses associated with litigation. So on control, what does this mean? It means it could be just attorney's fees. It could be costs of the experts, which are, you know, astronomically high these days, or a partial coverage of both, or perhaps all of it, although less likely. I think most funding today, most funding structures out there today are partial funding, with the law firm also taking on a bit of risk in a mixed contingency-like structure. On control, overall, the litigant has standing, not the funder. The litigant retains all rights to the claims, and the litigant has full settlement authority over the case. On information rights, the funder is not a party to the litigation. The funder is not a party to any protective order. And so the funder really is sort of standing back. The funder gives X amount of dollars for access to support or fund the litigation, and then sort of stands in the background, really functioning as a resource to the litigant if the litigant has questions or seeks counsel from the funder. The access point's important. Now, of course, this legislation is not just about patent litigation or intellectual property litigation, but I want to make it clear that access to confidential or proprietary information disclosed in the course of litigation is governed by a protective order, as is always the case in patent cases. And the funder is not signed on to that protective order. So the funder does not have access to any information that is disclosed and marked under the confidential under the confidentiality agreement or the protective order. And as many, if not all people on this call know, at least in patent cases, you know, most information disclosed in litigation is really marked what we call outside counsel eyes only, meaning that even the litigant doesn't see it. So certainly the funder doesn't see it. And even more importantly, the investors and the funder don't see it. The loans are non-recourse loans, as I mentioned earlier. This means that if the plaintiff loses the litigation, the funder is not entitled to any repayment of the loan. For this reason, and given the unknowns of both trial and appeal, especially at the Federal Circuit, the loans are viewed as pretty risky. To counter the risk, or justify the risk, I should say, litigation funders conduct really extensive and rigorous diligence on the strength of the case. This includes not just the strength of the claims, but any and all potential defenses that a funder could think of, the potential damages available in the case, and the collectability of the damages. The analysis is objective. Unlike a lot of plaintiffs themselves, there's really no emotion in the analysis. It truly is an objective analysis of the claims and defenses themselves. And this drives to a pretty robust analysis that more often than not leads a funder to decline to fund. Funders really only decide to fund a very, very small portion of those cases that are reviewed and considered for funding. And finally, who is funding the funders? So some funders are publicly traded. In the case of those that are not publicly traded, the private funders, investors can be individuals, family offices, or institutional investors. Investors in large funds like Fortress's fund are passive and blind investors, which means that the investors are invested in an overall investment strategy, but they're not consulted on any specific investment at the time of investment, and they're not privy to any non-public details regarding any ongoing investment. Neither the investment managers nor the investors themselves have access to any information produced in discovery beyond what the general public would have access to. So that's a pretty brief overview of what litigation funding does, who the players are, and how it's supposed to operate at a very high level.
Thanks, Courtney. That's really helpful. So I'm going to transition now into Jonathan and Kristen. And I would love for you two to tee up the Litigation Transparency Act of 2025. What is it? How did we get here? Sort of thing, perhaps Judge Connolly's orders, what has been kind of permeating in the background that got us here. And then we'll transition from there into some likely reactions from this act from the various constituencies involved.
Sure. So I'll just start out a little bit by setting the scene on that. So litigation funding historically in civil law jurisdictions was barred at common law under the doctrines of champerty, bear tree, and maintenance. But that started to ease about 30 to 50 years ago, depending on which state or jurisdiction you're looking at. A lot of those doctrines fell by the wayside, starting particularly in Australia and then moving into the UK and the United States. The UK actually barred contingency until much recently. And then when they allowed contingency, that helped open the door for allowance of litigation funding there. There's now litigation funding of both consumer and commercial claims in most common law jurisdictions, including Australia, the UK, and then also in a lot of civil law jurisdictions or code-based jurisdictions in Europe that have collective action or other sort of large scale recovery schemes. So a lot of litigation funding, a lot of the genesis of litigation funding in the United States and elsewhere was in mass torts. That makes sense because it's easier to concentrate the attention. It's obviously much more expensive, but the recoveries can also be very high. I don't know if anyone has ever seen or read a civil action, but the idea there was that they were on contingency and the company was just trying to wait them out over 10 years. And it was a big, long, expensive debate. And so the need for civil litigation funding in those cases sort of led to the growth of the industry 20 or so years ago. There was also some short sort of payday loan type loans that were given to consumer litigations where people were in med mal or in these type of claims sort of waiting for their check or waiting for things that grew up. And that is generally regulated at the state level differently because those tend to be state law claims. But what's interesting is that it's a patchwork across the United States of disclosure, licensure, limits, bans. In 13 to 18 states, there's some law that governs some aspect of it in the state courts. There's no law that governs anything of it in the federal courts, but there are laws in Europe that govern certain aspects of it. There's proposals there. And then there's voluntary disclosures that happen at courts and in local federal rules in the United States, in foreign arbitration bodies like the SAIC, which requires disclosure to the board and the body there. Abu Dhabi and Saudi Arabia actually have disclosure in their financial services courts that they have there. They have a sort of local court and then a court that's set up for large scale financial disputes. They force disclosure in those cases too. So it's interesting because it's a new market. It's a new financial product. So there's that aspect of it too, of it being sort of like any new asset class. And it's also sort of not the creature of statute as much as it is the absence of any kind of regulation or kind of comprehensive approach to it. A lot of people didn't even know it existed until very recently. And so the judiciary and the public and the users of it and the investors and even the potential claimants are all sort of learning piece by piece as some of these cases come out via disputes and via disclosure and via sort of this patchwork of what it is and how much it affects the system and what it means for all of us. So in the United States, at the federal level, there have been multiple, let's say, somewhat anemic attempts to address this. There was a piece of legislation, I believe, in 2021 that would have just focused on MDL and mass torts. There was another piece of legislation last term, I believe, from Chuck Grassley, from Senator Kennedy, I believe, that would have done something similar. This is a House bill that was introduced by Daryl Issa, who's the head of the Judiciary Committee in the House. But it does seem like majority Republican people that are putting up bills to sort of start to address this. The GSA and some committee hearings were held last term, or reports have come out in the interim. Europe has decided, the EU has decided that they're going to look into this. And the UK had a very major Supreme Court decision that rightly or wrongly equated litigation funding to contingency and put strict limits on it. And so they're now addressing litigation continually to try to sort of pull that back and at the same time either regulate or re-regulate or deregulate kind of how the UK has been treating litigation funding. But it's a patchwork. It's all over the place. And it seems like we're at a place where the judicial conference is starting to look into this in the United States to potentially amend the federal rules of civil procedure federally. States, kind of every year there's a new state that regulates some aspect of this or talks about disclosure. And so I think we're entering a period of maturity for the industry, whereas an alternative asset class that was sort of by its very nature a little bit opaque, you now have enough disputes and enough kind of pretty standard in any new asset class, but early fraud or early types of things that happened in an opaque asset class that regulators and the public and others are starting to become aware and deciding maybe we should do something about it. But without disclosure and without kind of anybody in the industry knowing what anybody else is doing because of a lack of disclosure, we're still very much in the information stage and information gathering stage, I should say. There's a lot of reports and a lot of members of the public and a lot of lawmakers and even people in the military and others that would like to know more, would like to understand how the industry works, would like to see what a good versus a bad contract is, or what a good action and an ethical action that is set up versus one that ends up spilling into court as fraud later, looks like. And so I think we're starting to sort of just scratch the surface of some of the issues that this very complicated new financial product is presenting. But I do think the debate largely in the United States internationally is centered around disclosure and not around regulation per se. I think we're still in the early stages of even understanding this tool's place in the system and how it's going to work moving forward.
Jonathan, Kristen, anything to add?
So much to add. I'm not going to fully disagree with Jonathan, although that is my normal inclination. But no, Jonathan did a really great job of laying out, you know, kind of the history. And importantly noting, you know, litigation funding isn't new. It's not unique to the United States. It's not unique to the patent system. It's simply not new, which kind of then, you know, begs the question, you know, where Jonathan said, but we're just scratching the surface. We just don't know. I mean, we do know. We've been doing it. And so I don't think the questions are quite as broad as Jonathan said. So kind of want to just move us a little bit into the patent space with it. To kind of get us closer to what we're, you know, the basis of what we're talking about. As Jonathan mentioned, you know, that one of the calls is to, you know, look at amending the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And to the patent point of that, it's kind of interesting. The parties that are asking and are supporting this this call, right? There was a letter in October of 2024 that was submitted to the Committee on the Rules and Practice and Procedure of the Administrative Office of the U.S. Courts, basically looking at this. Is a bunch of insurance companies, a bunch of big companies, big tech companies, and pharmaceutical companies. So some of what's being driving some of these disclosure requirements are big companies, insurance companies, big tech. So that's one place where this is driving. And the other thing that's driving this look, I disagree with Jonathan's perspective that the reason behind all the interest here is we just want to understand. I think there's something else going on. So, you know, one of the claims, one of the reasons why they're saying we need disclosure, right, is because disclosure is necessary for national security purposes. We don't want other countries to get their hands on our trade secrets. We don't want other countries to be able to understand what's going on in American industry. So that's not really, it's not because we want to understand, you know, what the impact of this new financial product, as Jonathan was saying. No, it's actually some of the claims as to why we're getting these laws at the state level, at the federal level, et cetera, is because we're worried about national security. Another big refrain, also, again, you know, coming from big tech insurance companies, is that litigation funding is causing nuisance lawsuits. It's nuisance lawsuits can exist and go further because of litigation funding. And so rather than seeking disclosure simply because we are looking to see what this new financial product is and its impact, there's actually reasons that are being said, that are being stated for why we need to have disclosure. It's not disclosure so we can learn. It's disclosure so we can protect national security. It's disclosure so that we don't have bad lawsuits. There's a lot of reasons. Those are really bad reasons. But I just want to, like, you know, take a quick poke at Jonathan there, that these proposed rules and the rules that the states are putting into place, and Jonathan's correct, lots of states are adding state level legislation to deal with disclosure and litigation funding. But a lot of the reasons being given don't necessarily make sense. And it's not really about disclosure. It's more about we're concerned about things. I agree that maybe we don't know everything. Maybe it is scratching the surface, but I don't think that putting the rules into place now, before we know anything, makes a lot of sense. So I'll turn it back to you, Casey, so we can get Paul on the call.
You mentioned national security, Kristen. Do you want to just tee that up a little bit and tease it out? Why are people concerned about national security with respect to litigation funding, and how is disclosure set up, poised, people think, to solve that problem?
So you take, for example, a suggestion that a Chinese funding company, which of course is China because the companies are all state actors. So there's a Chinese company. They are funding litigation, patent litigation in the United States, and they are funding it so that they can get access to, for example, trade secrets that would come up as part of a patent case. Oftentimes, those are kind of a hand-in-hand sort of situation. There's the patent that's the public document, but there's also trade secrets that accompany the business practice. And because this Chinese company is funding the litigation, we're very concerned that they'll have access to these trade secrets of American companies. And that would be very dangerous. So that's a concern, or even just for an investment in American industry is another concern that's raised with respect to national security.
Did you want to wait? You talked about protect orders and, sorry, Jonathan.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. And if I could jump in, I'm not sure how prevalent or not prevalent that fact pattern is here, but it did actually happen in a case in front of Judge Gilstrap where he found that a Chinese funded entity had misappropriated trade secrets. Now, it was not from a U.S. industry, it was from Samsung, but there were some misappropriated information about infringement that a former person there then passed to the funder. So it did happen in that case, but I would just add to the sort of national security component that I think it's probably true that concern is that it's nadir in something that is arm's length, like patents, where there's already kind of some obfuscation of where it is. But it is rather high in international arbitration, where I said, like, a lot of the international arbitration bodies that are private already require this disclosure because it's literally country to country that are suing each other. And there are some funders like Burford that will routinely fund claims of recovery against another nation. Now, sometimes they're funding it against the country of Argentina or the country of Bolivia or whoever. But clearly, it would be significant if it turned out that one of those arbitrations was being funded by a strategic enemy of the state or someone that country was not aligned with, right? Which is one of the reasons actually cited by the Singapore Arbitration Group when they recently adopted this rule on litigation funding disclosure. So I think in patent litigation, the sort of parade of horribles that the state secrets will make their way into the hands kind of on, you know, many, many cases will happen like this is probably not the primary concern of the driver for disclosure, but it certainly is something that has happened at least once and may happen again. And I think happens probably more in the international arbitration space in particular.
I do want to give Paul a chance, but I want to pop in. I think that Samsung case that Jonathan's referencing, access was not through litigation. It's that ex-employees of Samsung had information from their employment and there was bad acts there. The information was not accessed via the litigation itself. It was a claim that came up in the litigation, but it was not as a result of bad acts that occurred based on the funding at all. I also, one of the things we should do here today is talk about what disclosure, right? I mean, Jonathan talked about, well, disclosure is required in certain places. Well, what is the disclosure and to whom is the disclosure required? There is a real selling point here in calling this the Litigation Transparency Act, but is transparency always good, or is transparency giving a leg up to exactly the individuals who signed the letter that Kristen referenced? Disclosure that there is an existence of a funder is different than disclosure of what the funding arrangement is, the details of such funding arrangement, or as proposed by this act, which I still am just incredulous of, identification of each and every individual that would benefit from it. I'm not sure that this proposed language is getting to the stated goal of looking for sort of a safer and more predictable or more protected industry. So those are all, as we move through this, I would encourage everyone listening to really think through what is the disclosure that's required and to whom and from whom.
Yeah, sorry to keep jumping back in, but I love this. And we all know each other pretty well, so this is pretty common for those listening at home. But just wanted to add that we mentioned the insurers as one of the people that are interested in disclosure moving forward. Since about the 70s, the insurers who are interested in litigation and subrogating or who have an insurance agreement have had to disclose, as part of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, their full insurance agreements, which is sort of the closest analogy of a financial product based on the outcome of litigation. And so they've been able to do it without concerns since the 70s. That's one of the major analogies for adopting, or one of the main drivers of the idea of adopting a similar rule for litigation funding agreements, so that judges can check for conflicts and see the language. I agree with Courtney that when polled, and this extends to most most funders that I've talked to and heard at conferences and have written to, most people agree that funding would not be a problem. Most people said that disclosure would not be a problem, that in cases where there's been disclosure, there's been no issue. And that probably is largely true. And the devil then comes down to the details of what gets disclosed. So I've been on panels where funders have agreed, if it was limited to the disclosure publicly of who the funder was, that would be one thing. Probably be okay with that. Others have said that disclosure of the agreement, as long as it was sealed with confidential information, like other things under the protective order, would probably be fine as well. But I think the debate right now isn't really whether disclosure is a good idea or bad idea. It's more kind of what the scope of that disclosure might be. And so it's encouraging to see that debate sort of advance in a lot of jurisdictions that doesn't mean it's going to happen tomorrow. There will be a lot of debate around it and around what the ultimate language says. And I think some agreements and some judges go too far, probably, and probably get it wrong and publicly disclose things they shouldn't. But that over under enforcement problem will go away if there is sort of a rule similar to what was adopted in the 70s with the insurance industry. So,
Jonathan. Paul, I would love if you would weigh in. You're our ethics panelist, and you're talking about the potential conflict in the duty to investors and funders of it versus the duty of loyalty to the client. So I would love to hear you talk about that.
Yeah, let me go into that a little bit and then address some of the other issues briefly. So one illustration of how third-party litigation financing can really undermine the entire purpose of the litigation system is this case involving Sysco. So this is not a patent case, but it was a case involving Sysco, the food manufacturer, who used third-party litigation funding for an antitrust lawsuit against some of its suppliers. Well, no one knew there was third-party litigation financing until a dispute arose. Sysco, apparently seeing that they didn't want this litigation to continue any longer, it was creating bad blood with some of their suppliers who they're going to have to work with going forward, wanted to settle the case. It turns out their third-party funder prohibited that. They said, wait a minute, our contract says we are the judge, the third-party funder is the judge of whether or not a settlement is reasonable. Sysco said, we want out of this case. We're the client. We've made a holistic judgment about our well-being going forward and whether this continuing this case is helping or hurting us. And we won out, but the funder resisted, and there was litigation involved. And even more so, it turned out that the funder, a magistrate judge discovered this subsequently, was not only trying to maximize their profits in that one case, but they were planning on using their settlement number in that case in pitches to other funders in other cases, so that they could put in their PowerPoint, hey, we got this amount of money in this one case, come with us, invest with us, and we'll make you some big bucks. Now, what that illustrates is the undermining of the whole purpose of the litigation system, which is to settle disputes. Now, Jeffrey Hazard, at Yale Law School, and Andrew Cronman, also at Yale Law School, they're the sort of premier ethics writers on the legal profession. And they point out that the only way you can resolve disputes in the litigation system if there's clarity on each side of the V. The plaintiff has a crystallized position, the defendant has a crystallized position, and then you work it out in court. But when there's disputes, or there's too great a degree of control on the part of the third party funder over the client, then you end up with disputes on that one side of the V, thereby making it much less likely you're going to reach any settlement or resolution. So the key is not, well, I don't think anybody here is saying that third party financing should be banned. The question is, what is the degree of control that the funder has over the client? And the funders, of course, are going to be driven largely by fiduciary duties to maximize profits for the clients, for their investors. The lawyer is supposed to keep one eye on making some money and staying in business, but also the other eye on the well-being of the actual client going forward. And so the third party funding, when it's opaque, now Courtney could be, it could be true in her every case that she's worked on that that is the situation, but we just don't know in any given situation unless there's some sort of disclosure of the control elements, at least, of a contract.
And disclosure, Paul, to who?
Disclosure to the court and to the parties.
Why to the parties?
Well, it's the exact same reason, as Jonathan pointed out, that you have disclosure of third party insurance liability funding for defendants. The courts are universally agreeing that the reason that defendants have to disclose the terms of their liability insurance and whatever limits are involved there is because it facilitates the resolution of cases. It's good to know what the parameters are of the dispute, including who can spend what on what. And the flip side of that same coin, wait a minute, the flip side of the same coin is the funding for the plaintiffs. And right now, only one side of that coin involves any sort of disclosure requirements, and the other side of the coin does not. Now, let me.
I just have a quick question for you before you move on, because I'm going to forget it. Was the policy for disclosure of insurance agreements because it facilitated settlements back in the 70s? I'm not sure. I wasn't practicing law. I don't think any of us were practicing law then, but
that's
I'm not sure that was the reason for the disclosure.
I'm a nerd, and I've actually read through a substantial amount. There was a lot of controversy, and it went on for about 5 years at the time when they decided to adopt this. And the insurance agreement, the insurance industry originally opposed it for obvious reasons. Some of the things that were coming out was that, like, there were cases where the insurer funded both sides, and so actually the parties were at a disadvantage where the funder had done one side, or the court was invested and didn't know, or the judge had a conflict of interest. There was subrogation where basically the courts were mad that the insurer didn't say that they were the real party in interest. And then some insurers were asking for it because they were getting brought in as real parties in interest because of subrogation clauses that were then disclosed. So it was a very complicated and long-term discussion that went on for a long period of time. But yeah, I agree. It was a long time ago.
So let me go back though to it's interesting to know what the Supreme Court had to say about this sort of thing back in the 1960s. There was a case involving the NAACP. It went up to the Supreme Court. The issue was, to what extent should we allow third party funding of a case brought by the NAACP? And the Supreme Court said in that case from 1963 that in that case, the involvement was fine because, quote, no monetary stakes are involved, and so there is no danger that the attorney will desert or subvert the paramount interests of his client to enrich himself or an outside sponsor, unquote. Now, I think that's what people are getting at, is to what degree of control is there over the clients, and to what effect does that negatively impact the client's desire for their own understanding of a holistic view of the case. You know, and Andrew Cronman at Yale points out that an attorney is supposed to put themselves in the shoes of the client and try to feel as best they can the holistic understanding that the client has about the case. Funders have a sole fiduciary duty to maximize returns on their investment. And so that's where the issue comes in. And then if I could just turn to some of the other issues. Federal legislation. Well, one of the reasons federal legislation, and we could talk about the details of what the legislation should say, is important is because we've had a few cases where a few judges have required disclosure and various abuses have been revealed in those few jurisdictions. And to the point where Judge Colm Connolly in Delaware issued a blanket disclosure order. And in that case, in one of the cases that had been going on for several years, the funder hold the case rather than even reveal its identity. Now, no one knows who that was, but it certainly indicates that in that case, the funder was so concerned about their identity that they dropped a case that had been going on for 2.5 years just to avoid the disclosure. Now, since a few jurisdictions have required disclosure, what has happened? Well, we have a study from the University of Utah and another study that say that the incidence of patent lawsuits in Colm Connolly's district, where he has the disclosure order, have gone way down, and they've gone way up in the Eastern District of Texas, which is known as a more sort of Wild West jurisdiction with no disclosure requirements. So in order to avoid that sort of shifting of the shadow that might be hiding various abuses, you have to have one uniform rule. And you can't really look to the courts or the legal profession to do this, because the legal profession very uniquely is not governed by any regulatory regime that goes through a state legislature. It's kind of fascinating. Accountants, doctors, teachers, electricians, everyone else is subject to a regulatory regime enacted by state legislatures. Back in the late 1880s, the Supreme Courts of various states decided on their own to say the legal profession is going to be regulated by us. But of course, they soon punted it to state bar associations. And even the ABA says that's a largely neglected field in terms of figuring out lawyers trying to discipline other lawyers. And there's no, anyone who's concerned about these issues can't schedule a meeting in a state Supreme Court justice's office like you would as a constituent schedule a meeting with a state legislator. Therefore, a lot of these issues unique to the legal profession end up being unaddressed and undiscussed until we have a few instances of disclosure that expose some pretty significant abuses, which causes Congress in this case to attempt to at least get some more data for the court and the parties regarding what the terms of these agreements are and to what extent they're going to affect the ability to settle cases and the well-being of individual clients.
Yeah, you know, I was on a panel not that long ago having a discussion on this, and the chief, the general counsel and sort of litigation officer stood up and said, well, it's harder to settle cases now that there's funding. And there was this argument made that I think, Paul, you're making here, which is this would facilitate settlement. And the answer is it facilitates settlement for the defendant, right? I mean, what this does is it provides a defendant, if you're talking about disclosing the actual content of a funding agreement, to the other side. So let's set aside the judge for a minute. I don't think anyone has a real problem with the judiciary having access to it. The question is, should it be disclosed to the other side? And should it be, it is no bearing on the claims or defenses of the case. If there is a standing issue, I think then it should, I get it, that should be disclosed. But let's assume, or in this group, that it's not relevant to any claim or defense. So it's being disclosed and providing information into the ability of a plaintiff to continue to bring the case. The reason the defendants want that is not because they have some genuine interest in reaching the middle. And by the way, I'm not faulting them for this. It's that they want to settle the case for as cheap as they can. And so you're providing information that allows them to do that because they will now see how much funding a plaintiff has, how long they can withstand the constant barrage of defenses until they can't anymore. Well, and I suppose my argument would be
already requires disclosure to the parties of the defense liability insurance.
Liability insurance. Liability insurance requires, that's not right. The requirement is to show whether a insurer can provide payment if someone is found guilty or liable, right? That's very different. And so I really think this likening to insurance is a real red herring. But in this case, if there is going to be mandated disclosure of funding, of the contents of terms and conditions of that funding agreement, I'd like to see it on the other side. I want to know what the defendant's budget is for the case. I want to know what the approvals are, and I want to know if they can go outside it. If this is about facilitating agreement, then we should have it be equal on both sides. Now, I guarantee
two,
you
if
that
two
they
sides
won't...
of the same coin, then it should be equal. But just to be clear about
Let's
what
do that.
The rules say, I'm just quoting regarding the defense insurance. It requires the disclosure to parties of, quote, any insurance agreement under which an insurance business may be liable to satisfy all or part of a possible judgment in the action or to indemnify or reimburse for payments made to satisfy the judgment. Just to put that
right.
Out.
It's on the judgment, not on the legal fees and costs necessarily incurred.
Can I jump in, though? I mean, I think that there's the distinction that Courtney is drawing out is that the insurance company has to pay up at the end. And if we are worried about somebody's ability to pay their responsibility for doing something wrong, that's the insurance situation. What litigation funding instead is being used for is at the front end, allowing somebody to actually get to the merits of their case. So that's a very different, I agree with Courtney that likening this to insurance is a red herring, in that the litigation funding isn't the plaintiff's ability to satisfy some sort of judgment against them, but it's their ability to actually have their day in court. And so that's a big difference. And I agree. I think that
it is a difference, but it's only a difference between the defense side wanting to settle the case for as low amount as possible, and the third party funder wanting to settle the case for as high an amount as possible. And the reason Colm Connolly in Delaware issued the transparency order in the first place is because he was having discussions with the lawyers on both sides, plaintiff side and the defense side. And he realized that he wasn't being able to get a straight answer from the lawyers on the plaintiff side, because it turned out, based on his suspicion, that they were having to consult with someone outside the courtroom. So when I say you need to have some sort of disclosure in order to help settle these cases, it's because right now, when there's no disclosure, the people pulling strings on one side of the case are unknown to the court. And the court really needs to understand who is making the calls in the case to help facilitate any resolution of any dispute.
Yeah, I mean, my answer to that is then you disclose to the judge. You don't need to disclose to the other parties. But I do. I mean, there are a whole bunch of issues about litigation funding, right? And that's probably a topic for another day, because this is really about the Litigation Transparency Act. And I don't disagree with you, Paul, on some of the other points you've made and that I've heard you make in the past. But this is really about this Litigation Transparency Act and the requirements of the act. And because I do have, I know this may go beyond 10 and I am not able to continue joining, I guess I just want to make a couple quick points. One is, I think for many on the call, and it would be me if I weren't sort of in the middle of this, what's the harm? Like, why not be transparent? And I will tell you, from a fund manager and investment manager perspective, the reality is that if there is required disclosure of each and every individual that could benefit from a lawsuit. And I do want to be clear, this could be an investor in a private equity deal that's making widgets and has a contract dispute. Okay, it's not necessarily patent litigation, and it's not necessarily a company that's focused on litigation. One, under this, the current language of this proposed act, each and every investor would need to be disclosed. Every fireman in a pension fund, every teacher in a pension fund, every employee in the company that owns equity in the company would need to individually be disclosed. I don't know if that is answering or solving the issues that Paul here is raising. And some of them have fair points, but that's not what this is. So I would just submit that this disclosure is to shut down funding and to shut down investment in anything that happens to then make it to litigation. And I would caution people to really look carefully at the language itself.
We're running out of time. I'm just because I'm curious. Would you support an amendment to this that limited it? Let's put aside the in-camera versus parties thing for a second. But would you support an edit to this that limited this to the identity of the funder or person managing the funding, depending on the definition, and the agreement itself subject to the protections of litigation.
I have no, personally, and speaking only on behalf of the Fortress team and not all other funders, the issue, the concern is not a disclosure of whether someone's being funded or who the funder is. But the proposed language here goes far, far, far beyond. So that, yeah. And then, of course, Jonathan, putting aside the access, I too don't have any problem with disclosing it to the judge. But I think it's a real unbalancing when that information goes to the other side. I also want to, you know, it's interesting. We just had a Corporate Transparency Act that was killed in January.
Yeah.
The Corporate Transparency Act required much of the same disclosure. And in that context, you know, as I don't know who is following it, but there was a lot of whiplash. It's, you know, it's going into effect. It's not. It got pushed. It went back. It was challenged in court. It was, I think it was appealed and it was eventually killed. And that same, it's interesting because that was a lot focused on privacy. And here we have something that's not all that different, and yet keeps coming up year after year. This legislation keeps getting pushed forward.
Technically not fully killed, right? Enforcement killed, but I agree that that was a mess. And the whatever you, I remember the name of the database, as someone who had to comply, was it was an interesting.
Sorry, John. Before we lose Courtney, we have a specific question geared towards her from the audience. So, Courtney, is it an inevitable eventual issue that would arise, require governmental limits on investor participation in law firms?
I don't think so. I mean, I'm not sure what the legal basis would be for funding limits. I think the question's really about funding law firms, which is a lot of loans to law firms. I'm less familiar with that, so I feel like I'm not the right expert to speak on that. But I think there, in order for there to be government limits, I think you have to have a real issue there. And my understanding of funding to law firms is a lot like a bank loan to a law firm. It's just made by a group of people who feel like they have an ability to really assess the risks in the book of cases that the law firm is basically self-funding on contingency.
Yeah, on that point, it getting, there are obvious conflicts of interest that can present themselves when a fund and a firm misalign, or when the lawyers themselves are funding, or they owe money to the fund or something like that. That's sort of like 101 about just the conflicts of interest that present themselves. In theory, that people are supposed to, the lawyers are supposed to hold themselves to a higher standard. And I'm kind of far afield from what we're talking about here. But it's interesting because it's getting even more complicated now. I mean, there's a different funder that recently announced that it is, it now owns a law firm that's based in Arizona, because Arizona has now loosened the ability for law firm ownership. So whether it's a loan or full-on ownership, we're now presented with a new, let's call it ethics 101 hypothetical from law school, where it's like, A funder could own the firm in theory, or the firm could owe money to a funder. And in theory, if the self-regulated ethics rules are all complied with and everyone is told and everything goes well and everything works well, then we're okay. But it obviously presents some very practical and real world conflicts of interest that have already in some cases spilled into arbitration and litigation when funders and firms disagree or when people get misaligned. It does happen, right? So I don't think that's the subject of this particular webinar. We could have a whole other webinar on that, because that's sort of a new and emerging area of law that's actually pretty exciting and interesting. But yeah, there's definitely some very interesting, I call it the triangle, but some interesting conflicts of interest that arise in the context of litigation funding, where you have a firm, a funder, and a client, but the majority of the funding is coming from the funder to the firm, and the client is sort of there and in theory controlling. But when you think about where the money is coming from, at least in the context of the agreement, practically the financial relationship is between the funder, or at least substantially between the funder and the firm. And so portfolio deals can have added ethical issues that may arise that have started to come out in some cases that have spilled out of arbitration already. So, but that's a whole other webinar. We can talk about that completely separate from just basic disclosure.
Yeah, you know, the other thing that probably comes up, and it's a little bit what you were talking about, Jonathan, is just the question of who are these investors and what do they know, right? Where do they come from? What do they have access to? And maybe I've thought about this, would it be a solution to give people comfort to say, look, these are passive and blind investors. They are investing, because that's not always the case. But when they are, would that sort of solve by truly almost providing not the funding agreement, but the investor agreement that says, look, these guys, they don't know what specific cases, they have no say. They're truly broad institutional investors that have a lot of pension funds that have really large portfolios of investments and are looking for balance in their portfolio. Would that give people a little bit more comfort to understand that there is not a lot of access to information? There's no access to non-public information.
I know you only have 2 minutes, but I think that there's a lot of room there for discussion, because I think there are a lot of, it's not regulated in any kind of comprehensive way as a product itself. So people say this is what the standard litigation agreement looks like, and that might be the standard litigation agreement of people that hold themselves to a higher standard. But you might have people over here that are doing it differently. If there was an industry standard that was generally abided by that a judge could compare it to and say, look, these are passive investors, so there's no issue, then suddenly it becomes a non-issue.
And yeah, that's a good point.
These are very complicated agreements, and so obviously there's a million different ways to slice that. But I definitely think that financial regulators and people with national security concerns would have less of a concern if they knew there was a standard that was being abided by, right?
Yeah.
Casey, can I just say one more thing about this, the national security part, because it was only touched on briefly. Now, if you had asked me a few years ago whether, you know, a China threat was a problem with third party litigation financing or in patent law or anything else, I would have poo-pooed it, or at least downgraded it in terms of the priorities of concerns. But over the last few years, I mean, if you follow the House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party, they'll point out that and this is from the Democratic chairman or co-chairman of that committee. And he points out that in China, not only are all the companies required to have a board member that is there to make sure that the company follows the Communist Party line, but there was a 2017 National Security Act that was passed that requires the companies to facilitate any Chinese espionage program. And if you read Freedom House, which is a human rights organization, they have a lot of material on what they call Chinese transnational repression, which means they'll take a Chinese national over here and communicate to them that if they don't do something that's in the Chinese Communist Party's interest, you know, something bad will happen to their family. Now, there are many instances of this. And unfortunately, you can see if someone were threatened in that way, to disclose anything related to a patent or technology case, the threat of sanctions for a protective order would pale in comparison to what the Chinese Communist Party might be threatening them with. And this is serious stuff. If you read the Freedom House report, or if you read anything from the House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party, the Communist Party over there means business. They have there have been leaked Politburo speeches saying that they want to exploit any foreign law that would allow them to gain access illicitly to foreign technology. So I am my level of concern has risen with my proportionate understanding of how the Chinese Communist Party operates.
Thanks, Paul. Paul, you also mentioned previously, you said we could talk about what the federal legislation should say. Is there something that you wish it said or wish it didn't say that you, how would you change it?
My primary concern is the degree of control. So to many of Courtney's, I think Courtney and I agree on this, that level of control is an area of certainly more concern than others. And it's really the degree to which a third party funder is controlling the case. You know, the attorneys are supposed to have a duty of loyalty to the client. But if the terms of the third party litigation contract are geared toward, as you might expect, the fiduciary duty of the funders to maximize in returns for the investors, that's where the problem occurs. That's the conflict between the fiduciary duty to investors versus the duty of loyalty to clients. And to me, that's where certainly the court and also potentially the parties, when relevant, should know what the terms of the agreements are.
We are just over the hour, so thank you all so much. This was such an interesting and enlightening discussion. Really appreciate it. Thank you to the Federalist Society and Edie for hosting. But pleasure having everyone today, and thank you very much to our distinguished panelists.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Jonathan.
So thank you. That's all.
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to echo that on behalf of the Federalist Society. Thank you guys so much, Kristen, Courtney, Jonathan, and Paul, for speaking with us today, and Casey for moderating. We really appreciate your time and expertise. And thanks to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can stay up to date with announcements and other upcoming webinars on our website, fedsec.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.